Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of March. This is from a listener request, actually, given to us yesterday. On the air today, service is good here. Service is good. Thank you, Chrissy. The request was for one of the authors of a piece in the American Prospect, The Art of the Possible, 8 Meaningful Things Obama Could Do Right Now Without Getting Caught in the Congressional Gridlock. Susie Kim, one of the authors of this piece, a reporter in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, where she covers national politics, a former staff member of The New Republic. She's written for Newsweek, Slate, The Wall Street Journal, Asia, The Daily Beast, The LA Times, and other places. She was based in Southeast Asia as a contributor to The Economist and an editor of the English-language Cambodia Daily, also spent 2 years in Rio de Janeiro reporting on urban violence in Brazil's prisons and shanty towns. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Susie. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address, talk@wpr.org. And the article, just to give you a broad outline of where we're going here, these are the areas that are discussed. The president could do work in the area of nominations, Wall Street, the environment, housing, telecommunications, immigration, gay rights, and criminal justice. Susie, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Before we go to those areas that need attention, let's just spend a few minutes on healthcare, because as I think about it, I was really involved in the process of all of this as well. It was absolutely fascinating, the avenues that were used here and what avenue was ultimately successful, wasn't it? I mean, it was all over the place.
Absolutely. I mean, if you took a look at what things looked like all of just 2 months ago,
right,
after Scott Brown's election, when the Democrats lost, you know, the magical number of 60 in the Senate that they needed to override a Republican filibuster, I think hopes were pretty low, and the outlook was looking pretty grim. And the fact that the Democrats in Congress, along with White House, managed to turn that around in just under 2 months is pretty incredible.
Doesn't the time when they were courting Olympia Snow seem like forever ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there was a time that wasn't that long ago that there was still hope that there might be genuine bipartisan support in the Senate for health care, as well as any number of major pieces of Obama's legislative agenda. And it's clear that the environment, both in the Senate and in Washington at large, has become so much more polarized, with Republicans and Democrats now, you know, each taking up the positions on the opposite ends of the political spectrum. And so, you know, it's unclear whether Obama's hopes for having bipartisan support for his major pieces of agenda, and, you know, whether Congress will be willing to work together going forward after everything fell out over health care.
And it will be debated for some time to come whether or not he took the right approach. What are your thoughts about that 7-hour meeting of bringing Republicans and Democrats together, of this of having people from the Republican Party come to the White House? There was a lot of that going on. Was that a strategy that was time lost, time not well spent, or was it time well spent?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, that, to a certain degree, it was very clear at that point that the Republicans just weren't going to climb on board with the Democratic health care bill, you know, no matter what sort of concessions the Democrats were willing to make. I mean, that itself was clear. At the same time, I think it probably was a smart move on Obama's part just to force the Republicans to bring their arguments in front of the public. And actually, really, you know, I mean, you saw him debating directly with members of Congress and on real pieces of policy, on real substantive points of legislation, and really bringing it to bringing that debate out in front of the American public, so they could see that there were some substantial arguments happening about the merits of what the Democrats were doing, you know, aside from all of the politics that play out sort of as usual and have just got sort of gotten amplified over the course of the last years, the Democrats have struggled to bring this forward. So ultimately, I think that actually was a useful turning point in terms of Obama and the Democrats really trying to show and then contrast their approach to what their ideas the Republicans were bringing to the table.
Do you imagine that this excessive partisanship is going to be with us for the remainder of this presidency?
It'll be interesting to see what happens after this year's midterm elections. I mean, you know, we'll have to see exactly. You know, the Republicans were pretty confident that, and becoming increasingly so, as the prospects for health care reform were looking pretty dim, that they could even take back majorities in both houses of Congress. I mean, I think you'll expect the rhetoric on both sides to be amped up as we get towards the midterms, but. You know, if the Senate does end up, you know, if the Senate Democrats do end up losing their majority and Democrats don't have the same kind of control as they do over Washington, I'd expect the dynamic to change as well. And perhaps, you know, to a certain extent, there might be different kinds of bipartisan legislation being put forward as a result.
There's certain things that stay in your mind after you do hour and hour and hour and hour after talk shows. But somebody the other day was saying essentially the bill that we have here, the health care bill, is a Republican bill and a fairly conservative Republican bill. If you think of Republicans in the 70s or in the 80s, it was a whole different breed of people.
Absolutely. I mean, really, you know, the reconciliation package, which are the amendments that are going to be made to the Senate bill, will, you know, sort of closed some of the gap between the Senate bill and the House bill, which was much more liberal. At the same time, yes, I'd agree that, I mean, in the end, I think there will be something more than 200 Republican amendments that have been incorporated into this bill over time. And it is, you know, fairly comparable to some of the ideas that the Republicans themselves have put forward over the years, which just goes to show exactly how polarized the political environment has become and exactly how far the Democrats have gone to you just even get to this point of passing a piece of major legislation.
Mm-hmm. You talk in your article about big changes that are possible without these big showdowns, and I think probably many people have said enough of the big showdowns.
Sure.
They've kind of had it. And you start with nominations to make appointments during congressional recess. There are a bunch of nominations. Can you tell us how many that are all held up?
Sure. I mean, within after the first year of Obama's presidency, there were over 200 pending nominations. This is within the federal agencies and so forth. I mean, just by comparison, George W. Bush had about 70 pending nominations at the end of the first year. So, you know, obviously, to a certain extent, this is directly related to the gridlock that we were just talking about in the Senate, because the Senate does have to approve the nominations that come through. In the past few months, Republican senators have even gone so far as to placing holds, which means the nominations are held up and they can't be voted on just massive quantities of nominees as they've gone through. And some of the more controversial picks, I would say Don Johnson, who Obama had nominated for the Office of Legal Counsel, which is a very important position related to the Attorney General, over a year ago. And this has been held up for months on end, and the office has gone without leadership because Ms. Johnson had previously worked as a lawyer for NARAL, the abortion rights advocacy group, which, you know, has led to this kind of gridlock happening. So Obama, it is within Obama's authority to recess appoint these kinds of nominees if it's clear that this gridlock can't be overcome and this position has still remained vacant for so long. I mean, recess appointees are limited to a two-year to being in an office for 2 years, but at least, I mean, the idea that such an important position in the federal government will just be held without, left vacant for that leadership, really just altogether has a detrimental effect
right.
on how the White House can function and how these agencies can function. I'd add as well that there are over 100 pending nominations within the within federal judgeships. These are in the federal courts across the country. This is something where you can't just, you know, sort of go out and blame the Senate. The White House needs to take the lead in terms of prioritizing these kinds of nominations as well, and this could have vast you know, far-reaching effects on the shape of the judicial landscape for years to come.
And they need to take the lead in terms of what?
In terms of actually nominating, I mean, only, I think there were only 52 nominations.
Oh, they haven't even nominated.
They haven't even nominated people to this. And this, you know, this is partly, you know, due to the fact that Gregory Craig, who was Obama's top lawyer, departed last November. He was really caught up with trying to deal with Guantanamo Bay and Obama's hope to actually close Guantanamo, which is, itself has become sort of roadblocked. And the White House itself has obviously been preoccupied with trying to get its healthcare legislation passed and trying to revive the economy. So obviously, you know, there are competing priorities here, but to, you know, be past the one-year mark and have all of these judgeships still unfulfilled is something that the White House itself could definitely put a fire under.
And what's the deal with one senator being able to hold up a lot of these appointments? I don't understand that.
So this is something, and any senator, this is within the Senate rules, can anonymously, actually, although some senators do sort of speak up as to you know, claiming ownership over these sort of acts, can decide to pause the nomination process in order because they have some unresolved problem, or in the case of Richard Shelby, who did this over 70 executive branch nominees in February because he wanted to draw attention to a concern he had about spending, Department of Defense spending in his home state. Now, that kind of move is really frowned upon in the Senate. Is not really considered sort of good form to do so. And generally, you know, for the most part, such holds don't sort of go on forever. But I mean, at this point, where you have such a polarized and acrimonious environment in the Senate, you know, senators have taken to doing that kind of grandstanding.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to the parts of the article that you've written first. The environment, what needs to happen is strengthening industry reporting requirements to bolster regulation of toxic substances. How does the administration do that without a big debate in Congress?
Sure. I mean, to a certain extent, the Obama administration does have the leeway to go through the EPA and really just make up for lost time in terms of what we even know about the substances that are, you know, thousands of which are unregulated and which there is increasing evidence that these are harmful to public health. I mean, to the extent that the EPA of some 80,000 chemicals that are known in the federal government's database has regulated just a tiny handful of them, I think maybe four or so, over the decades since the federal government decided that they needed to regulate these substances to begin with. They're massively behind even in what they know about these chemicals, what manufacturers are required to provide in terms of the information they have about these toxic substances. And I think, you know, given the fact that this is an issue that has come up in public debate, you know, with when you have families and parents who are concerned about the effects of some of these substances on their children and on public health in general, I think there is, there really is the possibility of gathering public support and momentum for changes the EPA could make in terms of, you know, requiring manufacturers, let's say, to report when they're using a hazardous chemical in a new way that might be dangerous to the public health. Taking sort of simple common sense measures like that is entirely possible just within the executive branch itself.
Mm-hmm. Is this an area where there is less partisanship, do you think?
Well, I think there's the potential for that. I mean, this is the thing. There is a piece of congressional legislation, I think, Frank Loudenberg, a New Jersey senator, has been wanting to overhaul the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is called TSCA, which was established in 1976. So people have been, you know, there's been public pressure and also from consumer advocates for decades for the federal government to have more authority over, ability to tighten these kind of rules in terms of what substances can be regulated. Through Congress, the problem is, through Congress, you still there's still a lot of pressure from corporate industry groups that oppose such legislation. So it's unclear. I think there's possibility that this could happen within Obama's first term as president, but it still could raise some problems within the political environment in Congress right now, which is why I think it's important for the Obama administration to do what it can through the powers that it already has, and for the public, for public pressure to be put upon them to make these things a priority.
We'll move into immigration in a moment, which is probably something that's going to be dealt with fairly soon. Susie writes, overhaul the country's detention system for those held in immigration custody by supporting detention alternatives for low-risk immigrants and more robust independent monitoring of the rights of detainees. The president announced last August plans to reform the country's immigrant detention system, and we'll talk about that. Guy writes also telecommunications, how to get rural and underserved communities high-speed internet access, criminal justice, and other areas. Now that healthcare reform has passed and the process was absolutely fascinating, are there other areas, and our guest suggests there are, that changes can take place without big showdowns? This is in the American Prospect, and the article is titled "The Art of the Possible: 8 Meaningful Things Obama Could Do Right Now Without Getting Caught in Congressional Gridlock." Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We move now to a discussion of immigration. Susie writes in the American Prospect that 400,000 people are being detained in a patchwork of county jails, federal centers, and privately run prisons. So she suggests in this article that there could be changes that would be result in more humane conditions for detainees. That's a large number of people. It may be underreported as well, Susie. And what a patchwork system of holding people.
Yes, absolutely. And, the concern is that even within the existing framework of regulations that we have, because there are rules about that officials are supposed to follow in terms of how you are treating these people who are in detention, which, sort of pending a decision by the government of whether to deport them or not, that in some of these facilities, you have some really tightly run federal centers, but then you have a private jail that's contracted to a company whose job it is to, sort of make money off of the system. So there have been reports of really sort of extreme human rights violations, ranging from lack of medical care to people being deported, being forcibly drugged on an airplane, going back to their home country, as well as young children who are thrown in these facilities, even though they're supposed, by regulation, they're not supposed to be there. So there are some serious problems in terms of both the rules surrounding these detention centers, as well as the enforcement of them, that has become a problem of a scale that I think is seldom brought to light in public these days.
You talk about agencies conducting periodic audits and investigations into suspect facilities. Who's responsible for doing that? And is this a case, as it is with meatpacking facilities and food inspection places, that they are seriously understaffed?
Well, I think there have been reports. The problem is that the agency that's responsible for running these kind of audits and inspections, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, has itself been brought under fire and under criticism for even going, you know, so far as to obfuscate the circumstances under which deaths have occurred within these detention systems of medical problems not being reported for various reasons that, you know, they don't want to necessarily be held accountable, that some of these, you know, the officials running these systems, I mean, they aren't even well educated in the difference between an undocumented immigrant being held, which is a civil violation and not a criminal offense, and, you know, that they would treat them exactly the same as they would a prisoner that has already been convicted and found guilty. And I think there is needs to be a greater distinction made between these detention systems and the prison itself. I mean, both of which you know, need to undergo a significant amount of reform. But I think the problem of, you know, having an external agency at least checking up on the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, is one thing that could help, you know, ensure that these rules are being followed. And this is one thing I suggest in the story, that the Department of Homeland Security could empower an agency like the Offices of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, whose job it is to ensure that human rights are being respected within facilities to ensure a better auditing process.
And at the moment, they're just not on top of the situation, or they are aware of it and ignoring it? Or,
well, I mean, I think last August, the Obama administration, this hasn't been entirely off of the Obama's radar screen. They recognize that this is a tremendous problem. It is something that, regardless of the politics surrounding immigration with regard to whether undocumented workers should be legalized, tighter border controls, these are the sort of high-profile issues that kind of set off these political fireworks. They have made gestures towards the fact that they recognize this is a problem. They ultimately want to, you know, build federal facilities and have a system that is much more humane and regulated. But the problem is, you know, the changes that they suggest are still operating within, you know, the auspices of this agency, which itself has been the source of the problem. And I think the need to have some, I mean, ideally, immigrant detention advocates would love for a agency outside of the Department of Homeland Security, you know, a truly independent agency, to be able to ensure that these regulations are being enforced. But if that's not possible, at least to take, you know, an office that is outside of the ICE, which has been the source of so many of these problems.
And in terms of Congress taking up immigration reform, it certainly is what we've heard nothing but health care for a long time now. But do you imagine this is next?
I think that's still an open question. Mm. I think the problem is, you know, congressional leaders and Democratic leaders have, to a certain degree, made an implicit promise that you know, the politics around health care were inflammatory and polarized enough that various congressmen and congresswomen who are up for re-election in the midterm elections this year are, you know, taking enough heat for sometimes controversial stands that they made within their own districts and states to support the health care reform, support the health care reform bill. I think it seems It seems unlikely that a truly comprehensive immigration reform bill will make it on the legislative calendar this year. That being said, I'd expect the Obama administration will make some other form of concession towards immigrants, towards supporting immigrant rights, which is why I think, among other things, I suggest something like overhauling the detention system and devoting more resources to that might be something that there are, it seems, a common sense solution that there can be political consensus on.
Does it depend, do you think, in any measure on how large the demonstrations are, Susie? There have been some large ones.
Yeah, I definitely recognize that. I mean, if on the same day that the health care vote took place this weekend, you had literally hundreds of thousands of marchers on Capitol Hill, far outnumbering, you know, for example, the Tea Party activists who were there protesting a bill were quite loud. But, you know, it was a really interesting contrast to see just how hundreds of thousands of people could be marching along the sides of the same time, one of the most sort of historic votes, and certainly one of the most politically agitated showdowns in recent congressional history was happening just alongside of it. But I think there are a lot of competing priorities right now. I think the Obama administration realizes that not only are the politics around immigration reform quite tough, especially for some individual legislators who would risk themselves politically by taking a strong stance on this issue, which is, I think you would list along with abortion and some other sort of hot-button issues, this is one of the ones that is most likely to provoke that kind of immediate political controversy. I think the problem is that there's only so much time left in the congressional calendar and in the political calendar all overall this year between now and the midterms. I think the Obama administration has made it clear that they want to make a pivot to really emphasizing jobs and the economy and things that seem like they are a more immediate concern to everyday Americans. So I think it's tough to see how immigration reform is going to fit into that calendar.
Right. Our number, join the conversation, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org. Susie Kim is our guest. Susie is political reporter, contributor to The New Republic, Mother Jones. The American Prospect is the piece that she has written, co-written, that came to our attention from yesterday's open line, and we thought, yeah, we read it and thought this is a good show. She covers national politics in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones and is a former staff member of the New Republic. The changes that could take place by strengthening some agencies, by having the administration move forward on nominations to important positions, how things can get done in Washington, even though there is a lot of polarization here, that there are other methods that could be used. And the article looks at nominations and telecommunications, we'll talk about momentarily, immigration, criminal justice, at Wall Street, we have yet to talk about that, the environment, and also housing. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address, once again, is talk@WPR.org. And we start our calls with Dan from Marinette. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Say, the one thing that I thought was sort of interesting about this is we seem to be very concerned about ensuring or at least making moves towards this notion of bipartisanship. And just on a side note, it seems like the Democrats in particularly always seem to be worried about this, but Republicans don't so much. And I was just wondering what your guest would say about the idea of shifting American politics and practice towards more of almost a parliamentary approach, where the party that's in control or the party that's in office doesn't really worry about taking what the other party has to say in mind, passing the policy proposals and enacting the things that they think are most necessary, given the fact that the voters put them in office. And then if the voters get to decide the next election whether or not that was the right approach. You don't see, for example, the Conservative Party over in Britain bewailing the fact that the Liberals aren't including them in any of the actions in Parliament simply because they're not expected to. I'll take my comment from your guest off the air.
Thank you, Dan.
Hi, Dan. So I think that's a really great question, and one that I think any number of liberals and Democrats who do want to see things get done and have been frustrated over the course of the first year and so of the Obama administration to see the fact that Democrats have control of Washington. We have the party has control of both houses of Congress as well as the administration. Why don't they be bolder? Why did the Obama administration take such pains to try to bring Republicans to the table? For example, on the health care bill, which, the first, as Kathleen mentioned earlier, remember when Olympia Snow is sort of all about trying to court her and bring her on board. I think part of the problem is that, just in terms of the rules of the Senate, and I think there's been just increasing attention to the fact that on a fundamental level, the we have these rules that end up resulting in such gridlock. Democrats, lost their 60-seat majority in the Senate. They would need to, as they sort of found a way around that in terms of the fact that they could put a reconciliation fix and pass an override, a filibuster, which would only require 51 votes in the Senate. That was their sort of way around it for health care reform, but due to those kinds of the rules of reconciliation, you can't do that for just any piece of legislation that comes through. That's the problem of the fact that the Democrats just can't pass any bill they like with 51 votes, which they do have currently in the Senate. I think part of this has to do with a sort of strategic decision and something that I think is fundamental to Obama's own philosophy of trying to, not only to bring bipartisanship and try to take that approach to his priorities legislatively, but try to court industry groups. And this is something as well that the progressives have been very critical of. But, in the healthcare reform fight, you saw that although ultimately insurance companies and so forth ended up turning against the bill, you have Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical companies, which did end up staying on board through the very end, that did end up defending the healthcare plan, and whose support, one could argue, was necessary for the bill getting through. I mean, that's a judgment that there is significant divisions within the Democratic Party on whether it's worth reaching out to industry groups and to more conservative players in hopes that this will provide more momentum for things actually happening. I think that has been the calculation by the Obama administration, and we'll see whether given the fact that they accomplished health care reform in the very end by being partisan, by not a single Republican voted for this bill, and they took a big risk in counting on the fact that they could be more aggressive and more bold and bring a message that actually communicated the fact that they did have priorities that they weren't going to compromise on because they believed that those were, for the good of the American people. I think perhaps Democrats will be more emboldened by their victory on health care and the fact that they did achieve it as Democrats by not compromising on certain principles and a message along those lines that perhaps ultimately, the party will end up taking more of the approach that you're talking about, Dan.
And the president as well, is that what he came away with, you think, from this?
Well, I think it's definitely, there was definitely a lot of criticism of the fact that Obama kind of, in the interest of bipartisanship, kind of had a very hands-off approach to the health care reform debate until, I would say, the final leg of it. I mean, I think the meeting that you talked about in terms of bringing all these players to the table was one element of one turning point in Obama really taking the reins. And I think, I think that is something, that's the point at which the Democratic message on health care became much clearer, that they turned this into something that, that would pit their opponents to the bill against, their hopes that this legislation would help everyday people and sort of curtail some of the abuses of the insurance industry and sort of more kind of a populist message that I think was closer to being a partisan and sort of proudly Democratic message as a result.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Fine, you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good.
Got a question, though, and this has to do with the third branch of government, which is the Republican Supreme Court, and their willingness to basically turn over stare decisis whenever they feel like it. Why are the Democrats seeming to be so confident that the legal challenge put up by these attorneys general is not going to be something, we know they'll appeal all the way to the Supremes, and why on earth does anybody think the Supreme Court isn't perfectly willing to bust all precedent once again and say, oh, and by the way, you cannot mandate insurance on the states. They seem very adept at picking and choosing, so it seems to me like this would be a perfect opportunity for them to start suddenly falling in love with the 10th Amendment against states' rights and say, you can't do that, which essentially scuttles the bill. And I just see, you know, people like David Axelrod and all these other people saying, oh, yeah, no, we're confident, no problem here. Well, folks, you were confident about Massachusetts, too. Am I just being a doomsayer here, or is this a real possibility, do you think?
Well, I think that in terms of the specific thing that you're talking about, in terms of the legal challenges that Republicans and conservatives are now bringing forward, with even, I think, some 12 attorney generals saying that the mandate, that the parts of the bill violate the 10th Amendment and so forth, I think there have been decisions that have been already precedent set on courts fairly high up that indicate that is not... not really realistically going to happen, even with a conservative, you know, Roberts court. At the same time, I think you're right to point out the fact that, for example, just take the recent Citizens United decision made by the court, which was basically freed up corporate spending on campaigns that would allow them to influence elections and spend money in ways without certain restrictions that they'd been operating under in the past. You're right. I mean, this decision according to a number of liberal legal scholars, had violated significant precedent, and they were there's quite significant concern among this, even so far as something that's trickled all the way up to Obama himself and the top Democrats. I think you noticed during one of Obama's last speeches before both houses of Congress, when the court was there, he actually went so far as to call out the Supreme Court right before them in terms of, you know, he himself was very critical of the decision. And I think there are attempts that I believe the Obama administration and Democrats in Congress will make through congressional legislation to be able to take some of the teeth out of that Supreme Court decision. So I do think that there is a dynamic in play. And you're right, certainly, to point out that this is a branch of government that could end up undermining some of the Democratic priorities and principles.
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
No, I'm just, you know me, I worry about everything. maybe I'm seeing shadows where there are none, but this group is quite a group. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for the call. Yeah, I was surprised to hear so many, what is it, attorneys general, is that the right way to say it? That there were so many of them who were challenging this. Doesn't it seem like a lot to you?
Well, I mean, I think that these, the states themselves, for various reasons, have been disgruntled about this health care reform bill. I mean, among other things, there have been fights that have been happening and sort of dissatisfaction from Republican governors and a couple of Democratic ones that the bill would end up putting sort of fiscal pressure on states that they couldn't really support, especially within during a time of recession, in terms of expanded Medicaid coverage, which states do have to be responsible on, and so forth. So, there's been noise from the state level for actually quite some time, even if it hasn't been directly the focus, you know, in the spotlight. So I'm not surprised, I have to say, that there have been these challenges, which I think have been pending for some time. But again, I think that the idea that the constitutionality of the health care reform bill is sort of under fire, I'm not surprised that this is the reaction from the conservatives who've opposed this bill and, you know, who basically lost their fight to stop the legislation, that they are trying to do something to prove that they're still pushing to take some kind of action, that they still, there's still some possibility that something can happen. But again, I think this is more political noise than any kind of substantive threat to the legislation.
We have yet to talk about, and we'll move to that in a few minutes, what about the digital divide, high-speed internet access to rural and underserved communities, the importance of that, how that could be accomplished, and other areas as well. How about Wall Street? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And our guest is the co-author of The Art of the Possible, Eight Meaningful Things Obama Could Do Right Now Without Getting Caught in Congressional Gridlock, appearing this week in, or this month actually, March 1st in The American Prospect. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, Susie, let's talk about the digital divide in this country, how large it is, what the administration has said about this, how important it is.
Sure. So this is something that the administration has been vocal about that has been a priority. And in fact, just recently, the Federal Communications Commission basically laid out its plan for expanding broadband internet connections. I think they're aiming to have affordable broadband access to up to 90% of the public from that would be up from a current level of about 65%. This isn't a target they have for over the next decade. So this is something that is going to be a long-term project. I think it's admirable of the Obama administration to make this a priority for them and to really be able to increase access to rural areas, to low-income areas, to address some of these gaps, which have been an economic drag as well to underserved areas and communities. So, you know, while at the same time, this is something, you know, for which there hasn't been it's not quite clear yet exactly how the FCC and the Obama administration will end up executing this plan, how they end up paying for all of it. They have some ideas they've put forward, but at the same time, you know, the thing that I discuss in my story are some ways, some things that the Obama, actions of the Obama administration could take right now, and ways in which they can actually incorporate expanding broadband access into existing priorities and plans they have. I mean, one idea, for example, the Obama administration has made a commitment to investing some $4 billion in transportation infrastructure, something that, again, that's a priority for which there is bipartisan support and something that's going to be happening already that got started under the stimulus. The Obama could, along with their plan to execute that plan, actually install broadband conduits, which are within the roads and that they're planning to build and require public housing, for example, that is being built to have capacity for broadband. So these are sort of reforms that might seem minor, but actually end up entailing more than half the cost of installing conduits, for example. But ripping up roads and digging trenches, this is something that's going to be happening already with the transportation infrastructure building projects. This is something that is a common sense idea that could really accelerate access to broadband, which without having to wait for Congress to act on a separate plan or for waiting for all the funds to kick in. So there are ways to jumpstart,
right,
access building projects.
Bob from Nina, our next caller. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Great show, and these are some really interesting ideas. I guess I had a sort of a comment and question on just the political will and leadership ability of the Democrats in Congress to get things done. It seems like for health care, which was a signature issue, they fiddled around for a whole year and didn't get anything done, and really Obama didn't show any leadership until the last month or two, and suddenly, you know, now we have something. Just wondering what your caller thinks on, you know, I, as well as I'm sure a lot of other people, hope to see this embolden them rather than, you know, now they sit back and they're scared that they're going to not be elected in November. I'm hoping this will embolden them to, and Obama, to move forward more forcefully, especially since they know they're not going to get any cooperation from the Republicans no matter what they do. So they might as well just do what they want anyway. That's what we elected them to do, right?
Susie.
Sure. I definitely hear your point, and I think this is something that given what the Democrats have managed to accomplish, and as we were sort of discussing earlier, how much they managed to turn around in such a short time to pull this off. I agree that there are, for example, the financial reform bill, which is currently under debate in Congress, is something that there had been hopes that there would be bipartisan support for this, and in the end, they may well need at least one Republican senator to go along with this in order to override the filibuster in the Senate. But this is something that is a major piece of legislation that there is significant political support from the public in terms of being able to crack down on these banks and be able to prevent an economic collapse of the kind that America has suffered before. That, you know, I think you're right that the Democrats and Obama can't waste any more time getting too hung up on what they need to appear to be bipartisan, to appear to court Republicans, when it's clear and that even Senator Dodd, who's been leading on this, his own original partner on the bill has basically been dropped out of the negotiations, Republican Richard Shelby. So I think there are already signs that things are moving in this direction, I think, and the Democrats themselves can, assert themselves more forcefully on these issues that are at the center of Obama's agenda for the rest of the year.
Thanks, Bob. We go to Greg next. Hi, Greg.
I just want to get back to the Internet for a moment, because I think there's some issues there that are among the most important and far-reaching initiatives going forward here, and that is job creation and discourse of all kinds, and the fact that the technologies of communication and entertainment are merging so rapidly, and the ISPs have major Internet service providers have a great big stake in all of that, and their business plan involves all that, to wit the NBC-Comcast merger and things like that, to grow into these big and immovable colossus-type organizations. And for freedom of expression and just generally freedom of the press, I think the Internet net neutrality, keeping a rein on the ISPs and developing really fast speed Internet service that's ubiquitous is really needs to be an important aspect going forward. The fact that we've got at least seven countries that I'm aware of that are well ahead of us in broadband penetration into their societies, the biggest economic engine potential that I see and many other people see on the horizon is the Internet. The biggest engine for potential employment involves the Internet, and to allow the ISP's business plans, basically, and they have considerable wealth and influence to get what they want in their business plans here, is going to be at definite and decisive odds with the good of the country going forward. So that's basically my comment, and at the end of this I have to say that I'm always surprised when I talk. I'm not even that big of a computer hound, but I understand the potential here. And when I talk to people who live on the Internet and are very well-versed in all the community, I'm in all things technology, they're not well-versed at the risks that exist today to a neutral Internet in America. And there's every reason I ask people to join the just Google freepress.org, and that also can connect you to Free Press or Save the Internet. This is a bipartisan group that's had some big influence on the way things handled. It'll send you out action notices and things like that. Mm-hmm. If you, it's important to stay informed on this, because once it's gone, it's gone.
Thank you very much. We have about 30 seconds, Susie.
Sure. I definitely agree that this is a tremendous priority. I think there are global rankings that put the U.S. at 16th behind other nations. And in terms of ramping up economic growth, promoting innovation that actually does ensure that the U.S. economy can remain robust and really remain a leader, that this is certainly a priority. And I think one that the Obama administration recognizes. It's just a question of how much and when they plan to take action on this.
Yeah. Thank you, Susie. It was a very interesting article. I enjoyed the discussion.
Great. Thanks so much, Kathleen. It was a great pleasure to be on tonight.
Great. Susie Kim, our guest this hour. The article you can find online, actually, at the American Prospect. You spell her last name K-H-I-M-M. The Art of the Possible, 8 Meaningful Things Obama Could Do Right Now Without Getting Caught in Congressional Gridlock. Tomorrow, we'll talk about Willie Mays' new biography, authorized biography, is out about him. So join us for that conversation, one of our hours. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. And thanks to Chrissy for on-air production as well. I want to remind you I'm going to be narrating Lincoln's portrait, if I ever figure out what to wear, Sunday, 3 p.m. at the Pabst Theater, Aaron Copland's Lincoln's Portrait. Samuel Barber is also on the program. And if you'd like more information, go to WPR.org/WHAD. I hope you can be there to celebrate Lincoln and Copland and Barber. Great conversations ahead. Don't go anywhere.